have about 15 minutes left in the program. There's so many questions we want to ask, but we wanted to take this opportunity to hear a little bit more from some of our award winners whose work is so relevant to our own. One thing that you all have in common, all of your pieces, is that they involve in-depth investigations of a subject. And so we're interested in what kind of support you need to be able to do that kind of project well. Perhaps I'd love to hear from all of you, but Brett, do you want to jump in? Sorry. What kind of support do journalists need to be able to do long, in-depth investigations well?
Yeah, Circle of Blue, we're a nonprofit news agency, so we're kind of buffered from some of the commercial and time pressures. So I don't have daily stories that I have to file. So that's certainly one. Two is that we don't go into a story assuming that the reader has an inherent interest in it. We're not a trade publication. We're not the sports pages. So because of that lack of assumed interest, context is so essential to what we do. So we need some space to be able to put what's going on into the stories of today, into the big narratives. And for us today, that's a narrative of transition and change, going from a society where our institutions and our infrastructure is built for environmental conditions that don't exist anymore. That's a hell of a story, and water is at the center of it. So for us, it's that expansive context.
And Deborah, for your work, obviously you're working on a book and that spans the course of a year or years. How? What kind of support do you need for that? Money, I'm assuming, is one of the answers.
Financial support. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that has changed, I think, for me over the years is that it used to be that the book advances would cover all of that. They don't now. So in order to write this book, I actually had to do something I'd never done before. I raised a lot of foundation money. So there was never not enough money, but I had to go get it.
When you were going up against Exxon, Lisa, what kinds of pressure did that mega company apply, or did they? And was it subtle? Was it direct? And talk real nice and loud into the microphone.
Okay. So,
right up against your mouth.
Okay,
thank
it's
you.
On. Yeah, you know, we started getting pressure from them, I believe, 24 hours before we published, because they started finally to realize what we were going to write and what it might mean for them. So, you know, it just started with some fairly unhappy emails from them. Once we did publish, they started churning out a lot of blog posts saying that our reporting was, you know, had no integrity, that we were wrong. One of the things they did was we had published a lot of internal documents that the public had never seen before, and we posted them on our website, and they downloaded those documents and put them on their blog, so it looked like the documents had been available to the public all along. And we knew they took them from our site because they had the same rusted paperclip markings that from the, you know, copy machine on them in the exact same place. So it was things like that. You know, eventually, I think they took out some op-eds, you know, sort of the standard stuff.
And was there ever a moment where you worried whether your ownership had your back?
No, I mean, this story idea came from the Inside Climate News publisher, so we knew all along that, you know, him and the editors were all very supportive of it, and we double fact-checked everything a million times, so we were very confident in our
And work. I'm sorry, just a quick follow-up. Have they since tried to squeeze tighter?
Not really.
Great.
What kind of challenges did you encounter in the course of reporting the stories that we're honoring you here for today? Deborah, I think you have a unique anecdote in that regard.
I didn't really think a lot about this story once I made a decision to write it. I had gone to Delaware Bay to look at horseshoe crabs and shorebirds, and I decided to follow the shorebirds along the entire length of the migration, and I really didn't think about what that entailed. So when the National Center for Wildlife Research in Canada offered me a space on one of their research trips up to Southampton Island at the head of Hudson Bay, I said yes, without really thinking about what the implications were. And one of the first implication was that I had to go for 4 weeks because it was only bush pilots taking us in and out. That I figured I could do. Second implication was, you know, you can't discriminate against anybody on the basis of age, but I started getting a lot of questions about how fit I was. And then I realized I had to really make sure what I needed to do was go a couple of miles a couple of times a week in water up to here, just walking back and forth. That was actually nothing, even in the cold water of Cape Ann, compared to what it was like up in the Arctic. But the worst one was when they called me and said I was going to have to get a visitor's gun license in Canada. And in order to get that gun license, I had to get one in the United States. And I tried to enroll in a hunting class because I thought that would be the one that was the most suitable because we were going to the densest concentration of polar bears in the Canadian Arctic, but all the hunting classes were full. So in order to get the license, I had to go to the handgun class. And but again, you don't always anticipate what the scary things are going to be. When I got to Canada, the Canadians said to me, well, you Americans, you know, you're handgun happy. I'm sure anything that you learned was not relevant. And they sent me to a shooting range where they wouldn't let me leave until I could hit a target with a 12-gauge shotgun completely accurately. And that was okay. And then we got up to the Arctic and I had to practice against, you know, with tin cans on a barrel at distance. That was okay, but what it turned out actually was the scariest thing about it was not learning to use the shotgun, was not going through all the practices dealing with the polar bears, was not actually dealing with the polar bears. I think the most scary thing for me was being in the handgun class in the United States and watching my peers in that class and why they wanted a license to carry weapons, and that was really scary.
So, Tricia, once you convinced your editors that this is a story you should do, did you encounter any particular challenges in your reporting?
Well, I mean, I'm a document geek, so for the pesticide story, it was a lot of digging and digging and digging and realizing that, you know, as those of you who've worked with EPA records before know that, you know, the EPA squirrels things away in these electronic file cabinets known as dockets, right? And there's never just one docket, right? So, like, one document would be in this one would be in that one would be in, and, you know, then I'd find one. Anyway, so it was really just, like, pulling a lot of, I guess, a turning point for me came. One of the things that I often do when I'm reporting on science is I'll pull the paper itself and then I'll look at, if I can, get my hands on like the poster presentation that was done, you know, a couple years beforehand. And it's just an exercise I've always done because I think sometimes it's interesting to see, like, does anything change between the two? And there was sort of a jaw-dropping moment for me in that the study that the EPA was relying on to set the safe level of... So the story itself was kind of about how much is too much of the pesticides that are going to increase exponentially as the next generation of genetically modified crops comes on board. And in particular, I was looking at 2,4-D. So this was a Dow study that the EPA was relying on and that the EPA was using to say it's safe for all of us to consume 41 times more 2,4-D than the Bush administration thought was safe. And that level that the EPA was using, the new safety level, was far higher. It's essentially, they're allowing far more 2,4-D into our diets than any place in the world I could find, including, you know, China doesn't consider that safe, just to give you a sense of how high our new threshold for 2,4-D is. And when I pulled the, I was able to get my hands, I think somebody said that their son works for the Internet Archive. Actually, that is a huge, huge help to investigative reporting. On the Dow poster presentation that they gave at the Society of Toxicology, and and it's kind of an exercise I've done over the years, and it's never really paid off. So there's like folks who are like, why do you do that, Trish? But this was a jaw-dropping moment because I realized that the sort of key measures of toxicity in the poster presentation and the key measures of toxicity in the final paper that the EPA was relying on to set this, you know, huge change in policy for this pesticide didn't match up. They were different, you know? And so for me, I thought, okay, this is actually going to be a better story than I thought. So
I would like to know, with the magnitude of all your stories, there still must have been some great stuff you had to leave out. I'll open it up to any of the four of you. What comes to mind when you talk about stuff you had to leave out?
I think the stuff that's in there is pretty interesting. I put all the interesting stuff in there, so I think it all made it. For me, it was kind of eye-opening doing a story on septic systems, something I hadn't thought about at all growing up on city water and city sewer. And the magnitude of it surprised me, as how many septic systems we have in this country and the lack of knowledge about how they're doing. That was one of the obstacles, is that trying to draw national level conclusions from something that the federal government has no role in. It's all county and district and state. And trying to match up or trying to get information and data about how many systems are out there and what are they failing or not failing and where they located is something that was incredibly difficult.
What I found fascinating about yours is that you said you didn't have to get any editor's buy-in in order to do the piece. I mean, you get to cover what you want. It might be different at the Chicago Tribune or anywhere else. Do you think you all face a different dynamic in pitching stories or getting the green light to work on stories, since you're all working at somewhat different media?
For me, certainly. My editor kind of trusts me to find something that's interesting and relevant and make it interesting and relevant to the reader. So I have a pretty big leeway to go wherever I want with the reporting, even if it's septic systems that no one's really discussed before.
Patricia?
I would say, you know, I'm lucky that I've worked for the same editor for 12 years. And, you know, I sort of jokingly said, you know, he's like, what, you know, you're not a feature writer, right? But I faced that, you know, years ago. We were here at this podium, my colleagues and I, for a series we did on flame retardants. And when I originally pitched that series, you know, the response I got was, but, you know, I've got other science writers. Why would I put an investigative reporter on it? So, I can pitch a story on anything under the sun, as long as I make a good pitch and a reasoned pitch and explain the investigative nature of it. Had I just pitched the feature story without, you know, it spun off of an investigative piece, that would have been a little bit harder. And I would say, you know, as newsrooms shrink, right? I mean, you really have to, I think there's a mindfulness, at least at my paper, right, that there's fewer of us doing this, right? So you have to be really careful about what you pick and the impact of that story and how important and what kind of a broad audience that would appeal to. So I would say that it just, you know, I think every idea gets a whole lot of scrutiny, given that, knowing that we're going to spend a lot of time on it. In this case, it was just one reporter, but in the past, you know, the stories I've worked on that have been environmental in nature have been with colleagues as well. So I think, you know, sadly, that's the nature of where we're at, you know, in our industry, so.
I would just say that working at a small newsroom, we have to be very careful about the big projects we pick, because when we settle on a big project, that takes away about half of the staff, and the rest of the staff have to work extra hard to keep the website alive on a daily basis with short stories. On this project, you know, the thing that really got us going was two crates of amazing documents, so that you couldn't say no to that. And once we realized the scope of the documents, we had all the support we needed from the editors and everyone else to just go as deeply as we wanted to. So that was wonderful. I also want to amend something I said earlier. I had said that, you know, after sort of the initial stories came out, Exxon sort of stopped coming after us. What I meant was, I was unaware of stuff they were doing, but I just remembered a couple weeks ago, a reporter at Bloomberg sort of wrote a summary of what had happened since our series came out. And one of the things he reported was that Exxon at one point sent lobbyists to Capitol Hill to try to, I guess, say bad things about us, and then also to try to convince other reporters to fact check our reporting and pick holes in our reporting. Mm. But I guess it hasn't really happened. So, you know, that's good.
Can I ask a question, if you don't mind? Did the boxes of documents, which is like, you know, my dream. I love boxes of documents. Did those come anonymously, or did you, was there, can you explain, or is that without compromising anything?
I mean, I can't name
anything?
Who yeah, they yeah, came sure. from, but they, you know, they came from sources that we got through just shoe leather reporting, just knocking on doors, yeah.
Thanks, you guys. We're all out of time, but thank you very, very much for explaining the story behind the story of SEJ's winners.